Thank you for joining me today for Wealth, Health, and Other Things You Should Know. My name is Brian Beutel. I'm a Senior Vice President and Certified Private Wealth Advisor, Certified Exit Planning Advisor, and Certified Trust and Fiduciary Advisor with UBS Wealth Management in Boca Raton, Florida, who, along with my son Cameron and our team, are dedicated to our relentless pursuit of knowledge and to do our best to address our clients' most formidable financial needs. I hope you may find in each and every podcast an opportunity to gain new insight and perspective on many of the most relevant issues of our time. So let's get going. Well, I think you'll find today's broadcast truly amazing. And I want to welcome Laura Kane, the head of Thematic Research Americas at UBS Financial Services, to discuss what I believe to be one of the more interesting and well-thought-out reports I have ever read, titled The Future of Humans. Laura, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you, Brian.
Well, needless to say, it was a very comprehensive and fascinating report that you and your colleagues released with, I'd have to classify it as, very impressive content, including commentary from Nobel Prize winners. So for the overview for our listeners, we're in, which was kind of a new term for me, the fourth industrial revolution, which you note will fundamentally alter the way we live, the way we work, and relate to one another. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. So, I mean, what we're seeing overall is that this trend of very rapid technological advance, in particular digitalization, is really taking over and transforming nearly every industry in the economy. So this is what we mean when we talk about the fourth industrial revolution. We're going to see increased connectivity, increased automation. And as you said, this is going to change how we live, how we work, how we relate to one another. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, we actually saw a lot of this taking place in real time, with more of our daily activities transitioning to the virtual realm. And we think we're going to see more of this in the decade ahead.
Fascinating. Now, the report detailed a multitude of different things, but yet you've really kind of honed in on three major areas of change. Can you kind of give us an idea of those three areas, and why did you choose those three?
Sure. So the report was intended to focus on the future of humans. And of course, you can probably gather from the title that that's a pretty broad topic. So we had to narrow our scope somehow. So what we wanted to do was focus on areas that are central to the human experience, and at the same time had some investable takeaways. So this ended up boiling down to three major categories, which are our health, our happiness, and our knowledge. And we also wanted to, within those three buckets, focus on areas that were influenced by two major disruptive trends. And those are demographics, primarily focusing on the aspects of the aging of the population, as well as the rising influence of the millennial generation. And also something I mentioned already earlier, which is this rapid pace of technological advance. So our report is organized into three key chapters, which you may have guessed already based on my comments: education, healthcare, and finally, happiness and consumer preferences.
So I would imagine, though, with all this narrowed down to three, wasn't easy. You guys probably looked at a whole bunch of stuff, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, let's take one of them, and that's education. Why education as an area of rapid change?
What we see is that education is an area that's really ripe for change and disruption. And today we're seeing that there's a wide gap between the skills that our current education system delivers and the skills that are going to be demanded by this increasingly digital economy. And we see this mismatch already causing disruption today. And we think that the situation is going to continue to be a bigger and bigger challenge. And the reason for this mismatch, it goes back to those two drivers that I mentioned. One, technology, it's changing so quickly that the skills that we acquire during those 4 years in university are going to expire a lot faster than they did before. So we're going to see learning become something that, rather than take place primarily during our youthful years, becomes something that is going to be pursued throughout our lifetime. The second one is demographics. So what we're seeing is that We're going to see a higher concentration of youth in developing countries over time, where, as you can imagine, educational resources are already scarce. Some estimates show that about 58% of primary and lower secondary school children lack literacy and numeracy throughout the world. So there's a shortage of education in some areas. And then we're also seeing, sticking with demographics, that as the population ages and lives longer, it means that people are also working longer. And if you pair that idea of working longer with this idea that technology is changing very quickly, as you can imagine, it goes back to that gap that we talked about, that skills just can't keep up with this pace of rapid change.
Now, for example, I have a daughter who a good portion of the school year was remote learning. So was the pandemic a big factor of acceleration in this area?
Yeah, so I would say more broadly, we've seen that the pandemic has accelerated digitalization trends across nearly every sector of the economy. So whether it's in the consumer realm with the surge in e-commerce that we're seeing, financial, healthcare, and even education, as you point out. So we've definitely seen this shift toward the digital world. And if anything, the pandemic has served as a glimpse into the future of learning, with many students, as you mentioned, participating in virtual learning and relying on ed tech platforms in place of traditional in-classroom settings. So with that in mind, we do see a bright future for areas like ed tech and ed tech platforms. We feel that these platforms are going to be able to expand access to education around the world and also importantly help to improve learning in some ways. So being able to personalize and adapt learning to the individual user or student, and also be used in some non-traditional settings like corporate training. A lot of that can be done online as well through some of these platforms. So the pandemic definitely, like I said, it served to kind of provide a glimpse into what the future could look like.
So I'm sure people are listening, or the question is going to be, well, is there still going to be a place for in-person learning?
Yes, definitely. So we don't think the kids are staying home forever. That's perhaps is the good news for some. We don't see technology as a replacement for in-classroom learning, but rather it's going to, one, as I said, expand access to education to some underserved communities around the world. It can also be used to enhance the learning process and supplement it. It's particularly good for learning a certain specific skill set. So whether that's learning a language or coding or corporate training, there's certainly a place for online learning. I would also say that, another reason why we believe in-classroom learning is here to stay is that, as much as we're living in a digitized world and we need those technical skills, we also need to focus on what makes us human. So what can we do that the machines can't? That's going to become even more important. So those soft skills like communication, creativity, interpersonal skills, those are going to be ever more important. And I think you get much more of those in an in-classroom setting versus in front of a computer screen. The last thing that I would mention is that it's really fundamental. In-classroom learning is fundamental to modern lifestyles. We have more and more dual income households today, especially in developed market economies. And, without in-classroom learning, this would have a major disruption to family life and present a major economic challenge as well. And we've seen this during the pandemic. Many working mothers have actually had to drop out of the workforce during this time period to accommodate childcare needs. So in addition to just the educational aspect, there's kind of an economic argument here as well for maintaining in-classroom learning.
Now, one thing you mentioned earlier, which I find very interesting and for myself personally, is you're saying that the change, one of these big drivers, is going to be lifelong learning, I should say. Why lifelong? And then does that kind of tie into how we're changing socially, looking at retirement?
Yeah, so certainly I think we're going to see people working longer. This is going to require an upkeep of skills. So as technology changes and as people are working later into their career and into a more advanced age, there's going to be this need to kind of upskill and reskill. And this is where we really think, especially online platforms, can be used by corporations to help to train employees, to help supplement learning and really keep that skill set fresh. throughout the lifetime. So it's not going to just be a function of, you know, the four-year university anymore, but continuing to kind of evolve skills. And, you know, even over time, we could see certain occupations even go away completely, right? So you have to be able to be flexible and adaptable and acquire, in some cases, brand new skills to be able to maintain a place in the workforce.
Will technological advancements be able to kind of tailor educational needs like artificial intelligence? Will that be a bigger driver to really kind of be more specific for an individual's learning needs?
Sure. So I think artificial intelligence is going to play a role in some of these new and more advanced ed tech platforms. We can see artificial intelligence used to customize education at a relatively low cost. Artificial intelligence algorithms can be used to tailor learning programs, including both the content and also the teaching methods that better suit a specific individual's needs. I mean, if you think of people, for example, that have learning disabilities, artificial intelligence could really help to kind of tailor that approach to a specific person's ability and kind of mode of learning. You know, we can definitely see also artificial intelligence be used to automate some of the teaching process as well. So it could also make the job of education perhaps, you know, more cost effective, more efficient, and really to be able to reach more people. I mean, we talked about earlier that, you know, there is a lack of educational resources in some parts of the world. So, you know, if there's a way to kind of scale more quickly using some of these technologies, I think that will be an important driver as well.
Fascinating. I never thought about the aspect of individuals with learning disabilities and how that might be a great help to them. The other aspect, I want to switch gears a little bit, going to something, you know, it's on, I think, a lot of people's mind, and that's healthcare. And clearly, it's a very big and important area for change. Is healthcare the least served presently by technological advancement, in particular, as a major part of our economy?
Yeah, so I would say it's one of the industries that really stands to benefit most from digitalization and the influence of technology. So healthcare today generates roughly 5% of all the data in the world. But that being said, it's still one of the least digitized sectors. If you compare it to a sector like the consumer sector, where we've already seen a level of transformation take place within the healthcare segment. And part of the reason for that is that the data within healthcare is often siloed and not used very effectively. There's also major privacy concerns with the healthcare industry and individual patients' data. Of course, this is an important topic for really any industry, but I think healthcare in particular is very sensitive. So that needs to be managed properly. So, you know, going forward, I think there's a big opportunity for tech-enabled treatments to improve both health outcomes and the efficiency of our healthcare systems going forward. So there's a lot of runway, and this is certainly an industry that can benefit from this transformation and really have a very personal influence on our lives. When we talk about future of humans, I mean, this is an area that really is extremely important to our future well-being.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's a huge segment, as you said, you know, with significant challenges, I would imagine. But how, I think we're, although we're changing, I would think, but we're mostly accustomed to a traditional delivery of our healthcare. How do you see healthcare, the changes there, how are healthcare being delivered?
Yeah, so I think we're going to see a rising influence of telemedicine and other more digital forms of healthcare delivery. So I think, you know, up until COVID-19, there was certainly some hesitancy in trying some of these technologies. I think healthcare tends to be quite personal, and it's a kind of a high touch industry. And when you're dealing with your health, there is a desire to really have that in-person interaction. Now, I feel like COVID-19 kind of flipped this on its head, where, you know, patients had no choice in many cases. And oftentimes it was safer to access medical advice via the internet or through an app than actually visiting a hospital. And I think some of that behavioral change could actually stick post-pandemic. So let me just put some numbers around some of the trends that we saw. During the pandemic, some of the survey data we looked at suggested that the number of U.S. adults using telemedicine actually tripled.
Wow.
the start of the pandemic. So yeah, huge numbers. But that being said, penetration is still very, very low. In the US, for example, prior to the pandemic, it's estimated that only about 1% of the roughly 900 million annual physician visits that take place used telemedicine in the past. So the runway here is huge. So of course, not every type of appointment is going to move online. I actually had one person ask me, you know, are we going to go to the dentist? Are we still going to go to the dentist? Well, yes, of course, not everything can move to telemedicine, but there's certainly scope for expansion from the currently very low penetration levels. And it's estimated that the U.S. telemedicine market could grow by roughly 17% a year between now and roughly 2025. So the growth rates are going to be large. And, you know, we're seeing telemedicine take hold across really a range of specialties. And I think one area of interest that may not be talked about enough is also in the mental health space. We've seen a lot of these kind of teletherapy apps become more popular in recent months. And I think that's a trend that's also here to stay.
Yeah, it's another niche that it's one of those niches that wouldn't immediately come to mind is the mental health sector. For me personally, I've used telemedicine, so I guess I'm in that kind of small category. And my personal experiences were very positive. So I found it very advantageous. But obviously, demographically in the U.S., we're changing quite a bit. And is aging the prime driver of a lot of this change? And if it is, how do you kind of envision the impact on retirees?
Yeah, so aging is certainly a big factor here. We do see that people are certainly living longer. And we are, alongside of that, seeing an increased rate of age-related disease. Now, age-related diseases kind of run the gamut from, you know, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, dementia, and all of these diseases are very costly to treat. There isn't, you know, a single cure. These are diseases where the symptoms need to be managed over time. So certainly the aging of the population is one of the primary factors that's really leading to much higher costs of healthcare systems overall. It's making it more challenging to treat patients. This, of course, is creating that demand to have tech-enabled solutions, because technology, the hope is that, you know, it's not just about better outcomes, but how can we make the healthcare systems more efficient so that more people can be accommodated? And it really runs beyond some of the first things that you think of. So yes, we talk about, let's say, robotics and how robots can be used within, you know, nursing homes and hospitals, but it's also software. You know, how can software be used to make management of hospitals more efficient? So there's many, many different technologies that are going to transform healthcare systems. And this will, of course, impact retirees, as you mentioned. And I think there's certainly going to be a little bit of a learning curve in getting used to using some of these technologies and becoming comfortable with them. But like I said, the pandemic really did help to kind of shake things up and make people more open to trying some of these capabilities.
Interaction with technology, especially in the healthcare field, how, obviously, besides telemedicine or even the mental health aspect, what are some of the other like personal interactions, wearables, things of that nature? Do you see that as a big advancement as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, in addition to telemedicine, which we already covered, another, you know, really interesting area is one that you just alluded to, which is the combination of wearables and digital platforms, especially when we're talking about managing more chronic diseases like we've been talking about. So we're going to see that there's going to be an increased adoption of wearables and more capabilities in terms of digital health tracking. For example, many of us already use smart watches, which we use to kind of track our steps, our sleep patterns, some of these basic things, even your kind of heart rate. So there's going to be more and more of this. There's also, of course, already medical grade connected devices that measure things like blood sugar, blood pressure, home EKG monitors. over time, we're going to see more and more of just real-time data being monitored for abnormalities. And, you know, this data is going to be transmitted to patients, doctors, so that abnormalities can be detected more quickly, rather than waiting for those intermittent doctor's appointments to realize that something is wrong. So it's going to lead to better detection, earlier detection of problems, better ongoing management of chronic diseases. And ultimately, we feel that the data from these wearables is going to feed into digital platforms for managing these types of diseases. And diabetes is a great example. 34 million Americans today suffer from diabetes, and only 2 or 3% are utilizing such a digital platform as we're talking about. So the upside is huge there. So this is certainly another area that seems very interesting. And then just some other long-term investment areas that we've highlighted that speak to some of the trends we've been talking about. Oncology is an area that we have a lot of interest in, as well as genetic therapies. You know, these are two areas where we expect to see breakthroughs over the next decade, and quite frankly, where we really need to see some new innovation to try to keep up with some of these diseases that we expect to see. And then also in the age-related realm, Alzheimer's, dementia, you know, no success so far in terms of coming up with cures, but we do expect this to be a great area of focus in the future, and one that could really have some life-changing impacts.
Now, as a person, matter of fact, who on my wrist, I have a wearable at all those things you mentioned, heart rate, sleep, my exercise, I, you know, track all of those things. And I find the information very, very valuable. In your report, you talked about 10 emerging technologies in healthcare. Can you touch on a couple of them? And there's one in particular, because I guess as I've gotten older, I've gotten nerdier, for lack of a better term. I read everything. And, you know, that's gene therapy. And I think you mentioned that. But out of the 10, tell us about a few of them, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, so gene editing, gene therapies, those are certainly ones that are top of mind. I mean, gene editing involves, you know, permanently altering genetic material in a cell by inserting, deleting, or correcting an existing gene. So this can be used in a wide range of to treat a wide range of diseases going forward, you know, as well as gene therapy. A slight distinction there that actually introduces a functional copy of a gene into a cell where it's either absent or defective. And gene therapies are actually very interesting because we've seen some kind of use cases, some proven use cases already in terms of treating what we call monogenic diseases, where they're caused by a single gene mutation. So certain types of inherited blindness would be an example of this. So we've already seen some successful treatments. And what's so interesting about genetic therapies is it's not about managing symptoms. If there's a successful gene therapy, it's actually a cure for previously incurable genetic disorders. So really, really interesting stuff. And like I said, we're starting to see some proven use cases. So very interesting space to watch. Another couple of ones to highlight, liquid biopsies is really interesting in terms of early detection of cancer. So we touched on oncology earlier, but being able to use blood or other fluid to detect tiny amounts of a pathogen or cancer cells circulating in the body. You know, this is groundbreaking because it's much less invasive than traditional biopsy and could ultimately lead to earlier detection of certain types of cancers. So again, this is an area that's emerging. We already see liquid biopsy used in prenatal testing, for example. So, you know, it's one of these emerging technologies where, you know, it's not fully being used yet in the oncology market, but it's starting to get there. And then another one, smartphone-enabled point-of-care diagnostics. We touched on wearables a little bit and using devices to kind of track and analyze data. This is another interesting area, just how much our smartphones can do and our smartphone cameras even can do in terms of detecting and monitoring certain conditions. So, you know, this is an area where I think we've only kind of reached the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we can do with this data and information and real-time monitoring. So again, another interesting space to watch that I think could really be transformative for so many of us.
Yeah, fascinating. I, like I said, I've the gene therapy element. I've read a lot of information on that recently, and I would agree, and I would certainly hope for a lot of people that hopefully we're on the verge of a lot of major breakthroughs through CRISPR technology, gene editing, and the like that will help a lot of folks out there. In the healthcare area, where do you see the most compelling investment opportunities?
So I think it's across many of the areas we've touched on. So it's digitalization, telemedicine, wearables, and digital platforms, very compelling. And then, like I said, some of these breakthrough areas, whether it's oncology, genetic therapies, and ultimately addressing some of these age-related diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. These are some really fascinating areas where I think we could certainly see some, you know, big innovations that really change our experience of healthcare going forward. Oh.
The last area, and I got to tell you, I thought this was pretty broad area, and that is happiness. What makes us happy?
So we've gone where no financial report has gone before with this one. And we've looked at, you know, what makes us happy, and are we going to be more happy or less happy in the future? So, first, you know, just to touch off on, you know, what makes us happy. We've all heard this phrase, money can't buy you happiness. And it turns out there's some truth to it. So to be sure, economic prosperity does play a role in our well-being. So we need to be able to meet our basic needs and enjoy a certain quality of living and enjoy our leisure time. But numerous studies have shown that the relationship between GDP growth and happiness isn't linear. So this has shown up across a number of different studies that we looked at. And instead, what we find that there are kind of a common set of drivers outside of economic prosperity and GDP growth that do contribute to generally happier lives. So these include things like social support, healthy life expectancy, social interactions, close relationships, giving to others, a sense of altruism, even spending money on others and spending money on experiences led to more happiness than spending on material goods for oneself. So these are some of the common themes that came up. So we looked at a number of different academic studies, and these are some of the common denominators that, like I said, go beyond just this question of, okay, you have your basic standard of living and what really adds on top of that to improve one's mental well-being. So to answer your question, there's a lot of things that make us happy. So it's really a combination of different effects that really contribute to the bottom line there.
Yeah, and I think maybe some people might argue digitization of our life, positive pros and cons. I think there's probably both sides of the equation, and we're going to have to you know, adjust, because I don't see it going backwards. If anything, I would think it would accelerate. And, you know, one of those things you mentioned, which, again, I don't know how many listeners would be familiar with it, is augmented reality. And what would be some of the uses? Or A, can you explain what augmented reality is? And B, what would be some of the uses?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, listen, technology, it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? So we're spending more time in front of screens, more so than ever during this pandemic. And there are definitely some negative mental health effects associated with that. You know, the millennial population is among the most affected. In the U.S., we saw teen depression rates rise 63% between 2007 and 2017. So as you can imagine, the problem's only getting get worse when we're spending more and more time in front of screens. And eventually, we'll have even more immersive experiences with augmented and virtual reality, which I'll get into in a moment. But I do want to say that, you know, technology on the positive side can also help to also be a positive factor for our mental well-being. If you think about being able to enjoy some digital experiences, and augmented and virtual reality play a role in that. And also some of the telehealth apps and things like that, and digital fitness platforms as well. So it's not all bad. Now, getting a little bit more into augmented reality, this is a very interesting technology that we feel hasn't really fully taken off yet. And we don't fully understand all the different applications that we could see down the line. Augmented reality, essentially what it is it adds digital elements onto a real life scene, and it's typically displayed on a smartphone or tablet. So it's about enhancing rather than replacing your sense of reality. So it's different from virtual reality, which tends to be more fully immersive. And you know, we've definitely seen it used so far mostly for entertainment purposes. So many of our listeners might be familiar with Pokemon Go, which was that really popular augmented reality smartphone game, maybe about a couple years ago now. But we're also seeing it used in some other areas. So retail, for example, we're seeing some retailers use augmented reality to perhaps, you know, if you're in a furniture store, you want to envision how certain piece of furniture is going to look in your house, you can do that. There's also some really interesting use cases in the manufacturing segment in terms of training. So we've seen some companies use augmented reality smart glasses to augment workers' skills by overlaying digital video, graphic, or text information over physical work sites. And this has led to improved productivity and reduced error rates. So for example, at Boeing, factory trainees assembling a mock airplane wing were 30% faster and 90% more accurate using augmented reality animated instructions on tablets than trainees who were just relying on paper manuals. Wow. So that's just one example of many where this is an application that, you know, not many people are talking about. And I think there could be even more to this story in the future. So I like to call augmented reality perhaps the next GPS. So GPS technology, as we know, was originally developed for military purposes. And then once we all had smartphones in our pockets, all of a sudden we use this technology for everything, to navigate in the car, you know, navigate our run, navigate a new city. So you can imagine augmented reality is similar technology. It was created for one purpose, but who knows how we will be using this technology down the line.
Yeah. I mean, it's happiness technologically. I mean, as you touched on, it's more than just online gaming. But I was stunned because back a year or two ago, and I've been reading on it, that the growth in terms of the online gaming, there's now more people who watch streaming online gaming events than some of the World Series games. I don't know how many people understand about how large that is, but I just read an article on the term is esports, that it could hit 495 million viewers, and it's growing at an exponential rate. So as it plays into technology, do you see this more and more that even the viewing aspect of esports grows and continues to expand?
Yes, definitely. So this is certainly a growing area. It's definitely one to watch. We're seeing a huge interest in esports. The growth is coming from, you know, those younger generations, millennials, Gen Z. We're also seeing a lot of the initial growth is coming out of the Asia Pacific region, but we are seeing other parts of the world kind of catch on. So, you know, we're seeing more interest in esports in the US, also France, Germany. So it's not just something that's popular in Asia. We're seeing this story broaden out to other parts of the world as well. And we're going to see, you know, even more growth as esports become more monetizable. So we're going to see ultimately as there's greater kind of professionalization within esports, we're going to see, you know, the volume of events and sponsorship rise alongside of this. So it's definitely an industry where there's profits to be made. So we think that will also spur continued growth. And then some of the things that we think will kind of drive esports to the next level. I mean, live events are essential to the industry's growth. So we expect to see more expansion of live venues, such as the HyperX Esports Arena in Las Vegas. We also expect to see augmented and virtual reality technology, which we talked about, allow for new experiences within gaming and esports. So that could be another catalyst for this area to really become something that's even more mainstream and used by a broader audience.
So you touched on a bunch of aspects here. And you're right, in an area that I don't think anyone has gone before in your field in our happiness realm, which is fascinating. And so within that realm, the most, what would you feel are the most notable developments in that category in our future? And your thoughts regarding our happiness, regarding also the impact on sustainability and how it's going to change the drivers for our future.
Yeah. So when we think about the future of happiness, I mean, millennials are certainly top of mind, right? So this younger generation is, you know, they're what we call digital natives. So they've grown up with technology. So I think that's going to be an important influence on their future happiness. They're also more inclined to spend money or their time on kind of experiences rather than purchasing material goods. And then finally, this generation tends to place a high value on social consciousness. And we see this show up in survey data, for example, 73% of millennials are actually willing to spend more on sustainable goods. It actually even shows up among their food preferences. And I'm not talking about avocado toast here, but actually plant-based meat. So roughly half of millennials in the U.S. consume plant-based meat at least once a month. And that compares to just 20% of the boomers. And millennials were more likely than the older generations to state that it's better for the environment as their reason for consuming it. So we see evidence of this social consciousness showing up across millennials' preferences in many ways. And, you know, tying that back to what we talked about with happiness earlier, this sense of giving back, altruism, philanthropy, perhaps that aspect or driver of happiness becomes even more important for this generation going forward. And then from an investment perspective, we do think that this could be, you know, a positive catalyst for companies that are more sustainable, that prioritize sustainable branding. As you know, at UBS, we have a big focus on sustainable investing. So this really is a nice tie-in to some of the other drivers that we're seeing in that space.
So, wow, we've talked about a lot of different things, starting with education and healthcare and happiness. But out of the three areas, do you think that the impact of technology will impact any one of those three segments faster than the others? And additionally, which one do you think will have on the short term the most impact?
So I would say the trend of digital transformation across the board is probably the thing that we're going to feel most immediately, because this trend is influencing many different industries, like we talked about, whether it's, you know, consumer, healthcare, education, and it's really transforming our day-to-day lives. So I think that's something that we'll feel in the more immediate sense. And then in terms of the biggest impact, I mean, I would have to say healthcare there. I mean, our health is just so important to our human experience. It definitely feeds into our mental well-being as well. So it's just something that's really important. And I think innovations in the healthcare space, of course, has the power to save lives, transform the quality of our lives, especially those suffering from chronic illnesses. I mean, one thing we didn't touch on earlier was this concept of health span. So we know people are living longer and longer, but if you don't feel well as you advance into age, then clearly your kind of human experience is compromised significantly. So I think healthcare is the area I would say has the most promise as I look forward.
It says last 10 years that catch up with you, as from what I've read on health span, is that it. And if we can expand on that, which I think hopefully we're on the verge of, it'll be of a productive and a healthy life. It'll be absolutely tremendous for people. Again, I got to thank you for doing this. This was, as I said at the beginning, one of the more fascinating reports that I've read. And I think it was pretty bold. I mean, it was a bold report. You took on a lot of different areas. And I think that's what I appreciated. And what we're going to do for folks out there listening, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of Laura's report. I think you guys even went further into other segments, but this, I think people will find to be outstanding. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for listening to today's show. Remember to subscribe, give us your feedback, and to stay safe, healthy, and also save and invest in yourself, your future, your family, your health, and your time, and to try to serve others, and you will live a truly rich life. And for a copy of Laura's report, if you email me at brian.butel@ubs.com, I'll be happy to send it out to you. Take care.